now the star attraction today, the discussion items, private equity review, item five. I'm going to hear from both our staff as well as Stepstone. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning,
Brian.
Hi.
All right. 5A. So who's got the floor?
Brian's got the floor initially here.
Mr. Long, the floor is yours.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Here for a private equity review with Stepstone. I'm going to kick it off and just do a brief update on sort of 2024 ending activity, year-to-date 25, and then I'll kick it over to Natalie to really walk through private equity environment and, more importantly, our pacing plan and thoughts for 2026. Our private equity program, as you can see here, resides within our growth portfolio. We're expecting return generation both out of private equity, and as you'll see today, we're also going to review our infrastructure real asset portfolio as well. But they both sit within our growth bucket.
Can you pull that microphone a little closer to you, Brian?
Thank you.
So that everybody's hearing you.
Is that better?
Oh, I think that's better.
All righty. And just a recap on sort of the key participants that are involved within our private markets. It's obviously Sisera. We manage the private equity program, top-down strategy, bottom-up manager selection, and monitoring of those managers. The managers or general partners are tasked with sourcing, evaluating, and managing the private equity portfolios. And then Stepstone plays an important role providing advice and resources to Sisera on private markets, really responsible for the pacing analysis, portfolio monitoring, and reporting as well. The opportunity set that we're seeing going into 2026 for our private equity portfolio, very similar to 2025. Really focused on North America and some European opportunities. Really across all sectors, we're open to meeting with general partners across all sectors. The implementation that we're working on is primary funds. So we're looking to invest with GPs in their commingled funds. The sub-strategies will be buyouts, growth equity, and venture capital as well. Within infrastructure, similar geography in that we'll be looking at North America and Europe. Implementation will be similar in primary funds. And with sub-strategies in infrastructure, we broke it out between sort of core plus, and then value add. We're really focused on the value add opportunistic areas within infra, more higher returning. The core plus tend to be sort of single-digit type returns. We're not interested in that part of the market at this time.
Does value add present any better exit strategy than others?
I think on the exit strategy, it's really dependent on almost size of the ultimate company that they're exiting. So on a value add or an opportunistic investment, the opportunistic investment might just take longer for value creation, but I think that the exit and pass are similar between value add and opportunistic. Core, maybe a little bit more exits because of all the open-end commingled funds within core infrastructure.
Okay, I'm sure there'll be other questions about the exit strategy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
On this slide, are the indications year-to-date this year for, like, Adams Street and Singular Guffrey seasonality, or is it likely to uptick toward the end of the year, or is that ready to finish up?
We've seen some slight distributions in fourth quarter, but I think what you see here is generally going to be what we get out of the fund-to-funds for 2025. A little bit less so than we received in 2024, big year in 24. We expected a little bit less this year, given how strong 2024 is. But I think the general takeaway with all the fund of funds is they're really in distribution mode, and we're receiving constant distributions on a quarterly basis almost from all of them.
And Jerry, there is a seasonality effect just with the fund of funds. You have a seasonality effect on the underlying funds coming into the end of the year, and then there's another quarter or so to for the fund of funds to compile the flows and get them back to us. So we tend to see this show up more in the first quarter.
I'm just noticing that the other funds appear to be tracking pretty much what they did last year. And looks to me, you could see that as a drop off significantly.
It's that, you know, I mean, Sigler Gluff in that small market buyout. I think some of the underlying strategies within that are still not quite to the end of, they're done with their investment period, but the value creation is still working through. So we still have probably a few years with Sigler Gluff for those distributions.
You have a question. Last column projected remaining, it says throughout fund's life. Are the fund life all the same on them, or like how long is the life?
Each one of these general partners have a little bit different investment period, so the fund lives are going to stagger a bit through this. They don't all end on the same date.
Okay.
And this chart is by manager, so multiple underlying funds for some of these managers that have different vintages. But I think to Brian's point, every single fund that you've seen here is fully invested, so 100% or so capital called, and in harvest mode, more or less. So what we're doing with this portfolio is really just kind of tracking the cash flows year over year, because they're in kind of a runoff portfolio, if that makes sense.
And then just a recap on, this is just private equity. So in 2024, you can see it's about $230 million across four GPs. Trident was a re-up, so we are in Trident's 8 and 9, and Trident 10 was a re-up, their new fund. And then Arbor, Blackfin, and Castic were new relationships, with Blackfin and Castic being European general partners. So a good mix, we thought, in 2024 between existings, new, and then North America and Europe split. In 2025, we've closed on three investments: Arcline, Arlington, and Dragoneer, all North America middle market buyout managers. Dragoneer, a little bit late stage venture growth equity. And then we are in active diligence on the typo there, but it, really four funds under review right now, a mix of a couple re-ups and then some new strategies as well that we're hoping to close by end of year. So pretty active year in private equity, and I think going back to sort of the opportunity set, really plays to that opportunity set. It's sort of middle market, North America, Europe, buyout. And then on the infrastructure side, we closed in 2024 with Altor. Think of them as an energy transition, climate transition infrastructure group. And then in 2025, we made investments with Cloud Capital, which is a data center specialist, and then Tallvine, more of a diversified infrastructure manager in the middle market. So we like what we're seeing in infrastructure. There's a lot of opportunity in infrastructure. Tim and I have went to a big infrastructure conference this year. We plan on going next year. Just to continue to get our arms around this opportunity set.
What's just in a thumbnail sketch, what's the clean energy transition space look like? What is that, going from diesel to solar?
Yeah, you know, a big opportunity set that we're seeing with our manager is green steel. So big steel plants that are manufacturing steel, huge emitters of a lot of carbon, et cetera. This is a completely green plant. They're seeing really upticks on what they can sell that green steel, mostly to sort of automotive, et cetera. So we're seeing some of those opportunities. So it's decarbonization. It runs sort of the gamut, but we're seeing some of these bigger opportunities on these big plays, for instance, in green steel.
So is that carbon capture? In other words, because you're not going to avoid it, right? So you're gonna
The real manufacturing, the energy is coming from renewable energy instead of fossil fuels on these plants. So it's up in the Nordics, way up in the north. A lot of renewable energy there, so they're able to power this entire plant with almost renewable energy.
So that's what's making it's not super fossil clean. Friendly exactly. To use that term. Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And we should point out that with the energy transition and decarbonization strategies, these are largely European strategies where there's a regulatory structure there to kind of drive the market demand. We've done much less so in the United States, where if it's policy dependent, you know, if we're getting whipsawed between administrations, it's harder to deploy 15-year capital. In Northern Europe, we can deploy that capital, knowing that there's been a consistent regulatory environment.
And then just looking out to 2026 in private equity, looking out, sort of forward calendar, we are expecting some of our existing general partners to raise their next funds. We'll be underwriting those strategies, as well as just continuing to source new relationships across North America and Europe. You'll see from Natalie's presentation, pacing plan about $475 million plus or minus. And then very similar in infrastructure. Infrastructure will be new relationships. 1 to 2, once again, North America, Europe, about $90 million in projected commitments. So with that review, I'm happy to take any questions or turn it over to Natalie for a more wholesome discussion on the environment, et cetera.
Any other questions for Brian before we turn it over to Natalie? Not hearing any. Thank you, Brian. Natalie, the floor is yours.
Okay, great. Well, good to see everyone. Hope everyone had a nice holiday. I feel like this board meeting came quickly this year. So we wanted to, follow Brian's presentation with more of kind of a state of the market. So I'll give a general market overview. And I know there's been some questions on just the distribution landscape over the last several years. So we'll touch on that and some of the green shoots that we're seeing at that part of the market. And then, as Brian mentioned, we'll give an update on pacing. So in addition to kind of strong overall total portfolio growth, so that would be the denominator, you also had some capital flows coming into the plan. So we'll see an uptick in just the overall dollars that we're able to invest. And that's balanced with the increased target going to 15% over the last couple years. So we've been increasing annual commitments in line with that. And then I'll finish the presentation just with an overall recap on the performance of the plan over the last 12 months and inception to date, really, talking about kind of benchmarks and how it's performing relative to public and private investments. So just to kick off with a presentation on, or a couple comments on the market. So I've kind of grouped here a couple key themes that I wanted to hit on here. I think number one, just to kind of hit the nail on the head, you know, there's been a lot of uncertainty in the market, and I think generally speaking, uncertainty breeds inaction in the private markets. It's been a little bit of a different story on the public side, and a lot of that has been driven by some optimism around AI and some very large companies that have some positive momentum. But on the private equity side, you know, we've really seen lower fundraising dollars. We've seen lower capital calls, which means less activity. And less activity typically means, you know, less net new distributions when you think about secondary and tertiary sales from sponsor to sponsor. So that would be more like a financial transaction. There's also uncertainty on the strategic side, right? So corporations have been less active and less acquisitive, so that's led to less net distributions back to sponsors. With some of the clarity that we've had over the past year, you know, one, how some of the regulatory decisions have impacted portfolio companies, specifically to tariffs, and companies and general partners having a better understanding of which companies are impacted and which industries. We're starting to see a rebound in deal activity, and I think that's a confluence of factors that include, you know, not only a little bit more clarity around tariffs, but also, you know, lower interest rates. A very positive private credit lending environment, which I think bodes well for deal activity. But it's early, so we'll touch on some of the data that supports some of the positive momentum. But again, we've been in a slow period the last couple years. Where to find liquidity? You know, I think we're encouraged that almost all avenues are open. Some more active than others. So you think about, you know, sale to a financial buyer like a private equity fund, that would be kind of a private equity to private equity transaction. A sale to strategic, like a corporate. IPO market has largely been closed the last several years, and we saw some positive momentum there this year. And then importantly, we'll talk a little bit about the rise of the CV market or the GP-led secondary market, which has given a fourth avenue to exit portfolio companies today that we historically you didn't see much activity in. And that's really taking market share. Today it's at about 30% of exits in the market are through GP-led secondaries, but providing some nice liquidity. And then last, again, I know, you know, when you look at the overall returns compared to public benchmarks, very underwhelming in the short term. We continue to be encouraged by kind of the long-term outperformance of private equity. And then specific to Contra Costa, also very positive indicators in terms of your performance relative to private benchmarks. So we'll talk a little bit about the outperformance of your portfolio compared to private benchmarks across all time periods.
One thing that struck me in looking at the presentation materials was from whence we came and the sort of the good old days of 2014, 13, 15, outsized returns, right? Outsized returns in PE, bright, shiny, attractive object. And so when we structured the FFP, we put a lot of, you know, a lot of percentage on that investment. In terms of just looking at the last 10 years with the crystal ball now, right, of the last three, kind of in the dry desert. Any thought about whether the idea or the amount allocated should be revisited? In other words, have we learned anything about what's happened in, say, the last 3 years in particular, but maybe the last five, that would lead us to believe that we might want to rethink that?
Yeah, I mean, I probably let your general consultant, Tim, kind of opine on the overall asset allocation. But in terms of private equity specifically, and maybe I can speak specific to private markets more generally, I think we continue to be very focused on diversification, right, and portfolio construction. And so on the private market side, your portfolio is quite diversified. You know, Brian mentioned some of the geographies that you're in, the strategies that you're in. And I think importantly, specific to private equity, you know, it's really the one source in your portfolio that you're in small cap and mid cap exposure. So the public equity markets have obviously shrunk in terms of number of listed companies, but the average size or total enterprise value of those companies has gotten much larger. So there's a very small basket of stocks that are really driving that outperformance. And so we think there's some green shoots just in terms of the mid-cap space, and specifically, you know, Brian and I have been working to lean into that space to try to tap into that alpha within private markets. And I think you're seeing that on the relative performance compared to private benchmarks. I won't speak on how sustainable the recent outperformance in public equities are, but certainly it's been notable and hard to keep up with on the private equity side.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And I'm not trying to convey that anybody's getting happy feet or that, you know, there's some great rethink going on. I just think it's a fair question that we should ask ourselves, right, about this and whether there's anything we've learned or seen that makes us want to, you know, pause and say, you know, maybe it's not as attractive long-term as we thought. That's really all I'm getting at.
Yeah, I guess I'd highlight two things there. One is if we kind of rewind the clock back to 2021, when we were in the early days of the COVID recovery, we had a positive 60% return in the private equity book. Remarkable year. That kind of drained the coffers for the next couple of years here. That pulled a lot of future returns forward. They were very concentrated right there. So we have to kind of keep that in context here. So when we look at the last 3 years of muted returns, 60% happening in 1 year, it just takes the wind out of the sails for the next few years here. So that's one context. I think we're probably 3 years past that now. That should be mediating out. And so we, you know, I think from this point forward, that should be a lesser factor. Really on prospective returns there. The other thing I think is when we look at we typically talk about asset classes in 10-year blocks of time, particularly within private equity, which have 10-year vehicles. If we look at that 10-year period, you know, the returns are roughly what we expect from private equity. I think the thing that's been remarkable has been the strength of the U.S. public market economy being so far a huge outperformer. So private equity in the realm of what we expected, U.S. public markets, you know, huge outperformance. And so I think, you know, I would kind of direct your attention more towards, my God, the public markets smash expectations. Private markets kind of did about what we expected them to do.
But the duration of the investment in the private equity, before we think about a 10-year duration, but now it's kind of stretched out to 15 years or so, is that correct?
That can happen, particularly on those legacy fund-to-funds. I think, in 2018, 2017, we started going more direct. So now as the portfolio is migrating towards, you know, all those legacy fund-to-funds, which can have 15, 18, 20-year lives when they get stretched out, now we're doing the direct funds. So I think, you know, you're going to see that weighted average life drop down once the fund-to-funds run off to more the 7 to 10 year range.
And we'll hit on a couple of those points as we go through the slides. So just in terms of fundraising, I kind of hit on this up front, but it has slowed down since 2021. You can see in the chart the dark gray line is buyout capital raised, and the gray bar is about venture growth capital raised. And then the green line, you can see the number of funds, and the orange line, the number of VC growth equity funds. So I think that what really strikes me here is if you just focus on the buyout, the dark gray bars, you know, it's been pretty much in line over the years in terms of the total capital raised. And the green line, the number of funds for buyouts has been, you know, pretty flat, pretty measured, at about, 500 or so, funds raised per annum. The more notable difference you'll see is the orange line and the decrease in just number of venture funds raised. And I think you saw a really toppy market in 2020-2021 where there was a lot of capital chasing venture returns. As that market has moderated, the fundraising environment has been more difficult for venture funds than it has been for buyout funds. But it is a tale of two cities. So you have very, very quick fundraises, as Brian will tell you, and most of the funds that we're going after, that because we're so targeted with our commitments, are in that category. You know, the hard to access oversubscribed funds go fast. And then you have the funds that have more muted historical performance, less distributions, higher loss ratios, and it's taking longer for them to fundraise. Generally, I believe net positive, you know, fewer funds, less competition. Maybe in 2021-2022, a little toppier environment. And on the distribution front, you know, those funds that were raised in 21 and 22 have dry powder and very young companies. So those companies are still in their value creation and not yet poised for exit. But we are encouraged by the overall performance, and I'll talk about some of the revenue growth that we're seeing at the portfolio company level. In terms of new deal activity, some green shoots here. New deal activity is up year over year. It has been driven by some larger deals and specifically higher quality kind of premium industries that are less cyclical. So that tends to be where the activity is happening. So PE value and deal count both up year over year compared to 2024. If you were to annualize the year-to-date Q3, it would be around 20,000 deals and about $2 trillion in total deal activity, so up year-over-year compared to 2024. So we are seeing a little bit more momentum. Net new deal activity means net new distributions coming back to the plan.
What are some examples of the high quality opportunities where you're seeing some activity? Just by generally.
Generically, we continue to see a focus on technology, and I think that's driven by some of the interest in AI. Also, tends to be a little bit less cyclical. Healthcare companies have gone for premium multiples. You can see on this chart, we've actually broken down the multiples by value and premium, but those tend to be some of the industries that are most active today. And then we're starting to see some value-oriented funds get a lot of traction. I think that's a signal of LPs thinking that there could be an attractive buying opportunity in the next few years. And those multiples have been relatively stable. You can see on the left chart, dark gray line is value-oriented industries. Premium industries like tech, healthcare have traded for outsized multiple. We really think that's like a flight to quality. And so fewer deals happening compared to 2021, 2022, but really just the cream of the crop deals getting done. And some of that is CVs. If you think about some of the premium assets that are trading, call it crown jewels, where a sponsor sees the embedded value in that company and wants to hold the asset longer, those tend to be kind of in premium industries and higher growth companies. If you look at purchase price multiples by size, so the chart on the right, we've broken it down by small, middle, which would be total enterprise values less than $500 million, and then large global is total enterprise values above $500 million. You can see how much more premium large cap companies are trading relative to small cap. So we actually look at this chart and see a good buying opportunity in the small cap space. Because if you were to break down revenue performance or growth year over year currently, as you go down the stack in size, the revenue growth is higher currently for small cap companies. And so see some positive coming out of this.
With so a few years back, a lot of them were chasing private equity returns, and so that seems to be calming down quite a bit. Does that provide, we're still in the mindset of, you know, private equity targets, that does that provide Cicero with more opportunity?
Yeah, I touched upon it a little bit in the fundraising chart. So, you know, less dollars getting raised, around the same amount of funds, but the dollars are concentrated up market. And so we've been leaning in kind of to small mid-cap managers to supplement our exposure up market. And I think that's a nice buying opportunity because there's less competition at that end of the market and more companies, importantly. You can also see in the leverage, small cap versus large cap. So obviously more expensive deals getting done at the larger end of the market, more dollars chasing fewer number of companies. And really what you see is a remarkable kind of increase in leverage that's available. Mostly private credit. And again, we think that kind of turn increase in leverage at the top end of the market is really being driven by a flight to quality, higher margins, growing businesses that are trading. When you look at small, mid, large, again, pretty stable at the lower end of the market. You're typically looking at three turns of leverage. The larger end of the market, so large cap buyouts, tend to fluctuate more in terms of just the amount of available credit and the leverage multiples. So this kind of goes back to your question about dry powder. So interestingly, most of the private equity growth is in net asset value. It hasn't been in dry powder. So with a lower fundraising less active fundraising environment and companies being held longer, most of the growth is in NAV or net asset value. But I think an important trend line here to focus on is just the percent of dry powder as a percent of NAV. So that's something that we track. And importantly, the dry powder has, you know, absolute total dollars has come down for the first time since 2010. So I think you are starting to see where there's deal activity starting to pick up, fundraising dollars are down, and they're starting to use some of that existing dry powder. So a lot less kind of overhang or dollars left outstanding to be invested. And I think that's kind of a net positive, less capital looking for more deals. So I know we talked about distributions. This is really just a short-term snapshot, so I won't spend too much time on it. Here we're looking at just the Q3 trend line, and the punchline here is that Q3 was a slow quarter, but overall we expect 2025 to be up on the distribution front. If you look at private equity distributions over time, I think this is what you're really hitting on with your question, is that distributions have been muted really for the last 3 years, and this year is supposed to be flat as well. We expect this year to be around 11% distributions compared to prior quarter net asset value. That compares to a 21% average, you know, over the long term. So certainly funds are holding on to companies longer. They're selling to CVs, which is really just kind of trading the NAV from one hand to another. And in many cases, LPs rolling in those crown jewel assets. So we are keeping an eye on this. We have seen deal activity pick up, so I think that is positive for the next couple quarters, but certainly have been in a drier spell kind of compared to historical. If you double click on that last chart and just look at distributions by fund size, again, you'll notice another common theme where all or 9 of the 15 vintages small buyout funds have distributed the highest percent of prior NAV. So again, as we look to tilt our portfolio, we really are looking to capture some of that small and mid-market exposure that's less cyclical. One of the reasons it's less cyclical in terms of distributions is because there's many more exit avenues for small cap businesses than there are large cap businesses. If you think about a very large company, there's just less buyers that can make that trade. And so having multiple exit avenues open, like I mentioned, all four are really kind of open right now. Obviously, IPOs are more limited, but, you know, the place where we're playing in private equity, IPOs was not a very active segment or active avenue for exits. It was really more sponsor to sponsor, sale to strategic backer, and now CVs. And then I think, you know, just in terms of a final point on exit volumes, again, been muted. We're seeing some positive momentum on the exit activity. We do expect 2025 to be up. And here I've segmented the exits by the type of sale. As I mentioned up front, about a third of exit activity in the last 12 months has been sale to a financial buyer, about a third has been sale to a strategic buyer, and about a third has been sale through a secondary or a CV. Here you can see just the sheer dollars up year over year, and I think really kind of compares favorably if you analyze the numbers compared to the kind of the last 10 years or trend line.
What's the and it's probably inherited. I don't remember reading it. What's the discount, the haircut for LPs who want to exit on your lower right hand? You know, the secondary market.
You know, it varies widely. So it really depends on the asset. I don't think a GP would look to do a CV if it was going to be a mere material discount to net asset value. In some cases, the only discount is the appreciation of the asset between the record date and when you actually close. And so you're underwriting a company based on, you know, a past record date, say it's Q3, but you actually close in Q1. And so you capture the value in the time horizon that it takes to actually close the asset. And so a lot of the underwriting goes into what's the go forward outlook for the business, both in the short term, you know, record to close, as well as the long term to final exit. I think the funds, you know, if you're talking about the LP secondaries, the funds that trade or have the highest discount would be fund of funds because they're so diversified and there, you know, there's two layers of fees, or venture funds go for kind of material premiums material discounts depending on which ones they are, just because the lockup time to liquidity and the share volume of portfolio companies in those funds. By and large, most GP-leds you are trading around NAV. And so you're underwriting off of the go-forward opportunity in that asset, looking at the asset as kind of a fresh investment and starting the clock day one and buying some more time to add value. So maybe just to recap, you know, challenging couple of years for private equity, and when I say challenging, more specific to deal activity, fundraising, and distributions. The theme that we've been talking about the last couple years has been more about staying disciplined and patient. It's a long-term asset class. There are ebbs and flows, as Tim mentioned, and on a relative basis, underperforming publics, but on an absolute basis, you have most of the investments in line with expectations. Starting to see some positive momentum, positive financial market sentiment, credit availability and lower interest rates, some clarity on tariffs and the impacted industries, and then just deal activity picking up, which means distributions coming back. So that was kind of it for prepared remarks. Happy to answer any questions about the market. Otherwise, thought we could talk about Contra Costa's portfolio specifically and pacing.
All right. Any other or further questions for Natalie on Victoria Lloyd Trevor? All right.
Okay, great. All right. Well, Brian stole my thunder, but the punchline is based on the positive performance of the overall plan and some contributions, the total portfolio is sitting at $13 billion today. Private equity is about $1.3 billion as of 9/30. And based on that increase in the denominator, to reach a target allocation of 15%, we're recommending a slight increase from $425 million recommended last year to $475 million this year on a go-forward basis. This is why we do this exercise annually, because markets change, the numerator changes, the private equity NAV, as NAV rolls off, you may start to increase this even further. If NAV doesn't roll off as quickly as we anticipate, then you would kind of pull back the annual pacing in line with target. So we're at about 10-11% today, and with a long-term target of 15%. And so I think to answer your earlier question about exposure, I think this is in line with other similarly sized public pensions that we work with, and personally feel comfortable with that 15% target. On the real asset side, again, going from $75 million to $90 million recommended pacing, and Brian's found some really interesting opportunities, I think, on the real assets and infrastructure side, and we'll be working with our team next year to kind of build out that pipeline further. In terms of portfolio performance, this is kind of an eye chart, so bear with me. I'll just point out a few things. One, importantly, year over year, the total value of the private equity portfolio increased by $300 million. In addition to that, you saw a distributed capital of $141 million, balanced by close to $190 million of capital calls. Those capital calls are really weighted towards more recent investments that we've made that are starting to pick up on deal activity, so view that as positive. But overall, kind of performance a little bit up on a quarterly basis, a little bit down on an annual basis, but mostly flat year over year. Inception to date performance at 12%, very admirable. And the portfolio value as a multiple of capital called sits at 1.7x, And I think probably the most important number on here is DPI. So, you know, for every dollar that has been called, you've gotten a dollar and change back. So again, the NAV is really upside from here. In terms of benchmarks, I kind of previewed this before, but overall, very solid performance compared to public and private benchmarks long-term, long-term being the operable word. I think I would focus on, you know, certainly the 10-year and since inception returns, you know, as a long-term asset class. The five-year returns have also been notable as well. We consider five-year and private equity kind of mid-term. But that does compare to 17.5% for the S&P 500, which is just
high. And that five-year captures 21, right?
Right, exactly. And so if you look at private benchmarks, you've outperformed in all time periods. So feel really good that you're outperforming the overall investable universe as an index.
Could you explain the benchmark that we use for private investments and quite a challenge to come up with solid benchmark, private market? So why are we using this and what does that reflect? Can you explain that benchmark?
Yeah, so we use a benchmark provider called Burgess. We did a comprehensive study on all the available third-party benchmarks, about 5 years ago, and found that Burgess had the most complete, comprehensive set of data, and importantly, was self-reported, and so getting kind of more higher quality data. The benchmark that we're showing here is the universe of private equity funds, so I think it's global and specific to private equity median returns. So basically taking that whole investable universe and taking the median of what an investor could expect to get.
Would it be more appropriate to get a benchmark that reflects our specific investments, like, you know, in public markets? We look at large cap versus the 500 and so forth. So this is a pretty broad benchmark, right? Is there anything that...
We do weight it by vintage years. So it is reflective of the years that you've been investing in private equity. But to your point, yes, it is almost, you know, all private equity generally. I think we could weight it potentially towards your geographic split if you wanted to weight U.S. higher, since you're predominantly investing in the U.S., but we have made intentional effort to diversify outside the U.S. as well.
So, yeah. go ahead.
Well, I was going to say not so much geographic, but I mean actually investment.
I think about the benchmarks in terms of the public benchmark being, are you being rewarded for investing in the asset class, right? It's like a relative choice. And then the private benchmark, really its purpose is, how are you doing compared to your peers? So out of all the investable opportunities, how have you done relative to the median?
Yeah, I think part of what's behind David's question, and if I've got this wrong, David, stop me, but in what I like to call the good old days, when we went in the early days of our PE analysis, I'm pretty sure we were using benchmark of S&P 500 plus 4%, somewhere in that range. I think that's when
that was the legacy benchmark, yeah.
Right. So that was the legacy benchmark. And then we went through an extended period with our prior investment consultant of different benchmark studies, and it was a journey. Let's just put it that way. We had a lot of discussion about it. We had a lot of refinements to that. So, and this one's been elusive, I think, is what I would say. The the private equity benchmark and what it means and how and what, whether it's telling us something. This one's gotten a lot of airtime here, just from the history. I just wanted you to know the background on it. That's what I think in part is behind the question, because it's been a bit of a riddle to try to get a benchmark that reflects what the performance of that asset class really is.
And you're not alone. I think benchmarking private investments is challenging. On the public side, we do have clients that go a little bit broader and more global, so they use the MSCI. We also have clients who skew more towards small cap companies, so they use the Russell. On the private, so this is, you know, kind of, I guess the S&P is kind of a middle ground and more U.S. centric. On the private side, this is a pretty widely used benchmark, and I think the goal here is to find a benchmark that captures the largest data set and the highest quality data.
So on the private side, I mean,
it's not an investable benchmark.
Right, on the private side. So let's say if we did 100% buyout, that's our private equity. We're just doing all buyouts.
Yep.
Do we use a benchmark that compares us to the buyout world or all the other buyout investments, or do we use a benchmark so that there's more of a apples to apples comparison, or do we use a benchmark that does all private equity across the globe kind of thing? What's the value of the benchmark then? So that's what I'm getting at. Can we actually tailor a benchmark in private markets that more reflects our own investments so that we can have a real comparison and how we're doing?
Yeah, and I think the overall private equity index, I'd have to check on this one we're showing, but typically is around 60% buyout, and so is in line with contra costs target, maybe a little bit lower than what you're doing. I think the overall index probably has more opportunistic, distressed restructuring and venture than this portfolio has. I think our venture exposure is around 15% today, and I would think the index is probably closer to around 20%, but we can look into that.
I just want the benchmarks to be as meaningful as possible.
Understood.
Yeah.
You could have a weighted benchmark based on your specific percents to geographies. We're already doing vintages, so it is capturing the years that you've invested and the relative choice of what you could invest in versus what you did invest in.
Well, I'm sure I'm looking at our friends from Makita sitting behind me, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest in this, and he's listening keenly to this. So
great.
I'm sure there'll be more.
And happy to contribute to that discussion. We work with clients all the time to kind of find the perfect, if there is one, but the most perfect kind of benchmark for their portfolios. So if we want to double click on that, we can come back to that.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, help whatever tool we use to see our track record, how we're doing, with manager selection, because again, right, the upper quartile performing managers in private equity, those are the ones, that's where you want to be. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that we're there?
Yep. Great.
Good. We've got a pin in it. We're good.
Private equity value. So here we just break down the contributions, distributions, net gain. On the left side, you can see the annual change. On the right side, you can see the total inception to date increase in value, market value. So as I mentioned, about $110 million of net gain for the year, and inception to date, You can see in, let's see, the green 1.3 billion of gain compared to a market value of about 1.3 billion.
And then just to highlight, so when you're looking at overall value and you have a negative for distributions, then just for folks to understand that that's money that actually comes into our system and that we can use for like more private equity or for pension payments or whatever.
Exactly.
I mean that.
Yeah, it's showing a negative, but it's actually a positive in your pocket. Exactly.
Your square is a good thing. Yeah.
Good point. Private equity exposure by sub-portfolio. So here, this is a chart we've showed the last couple years just in terms of the go-forward strategy. So on the left, you have back in 2017, when we first started working with you, predominantly kind of a fund-to-funds, more passive approach, going to a more direct model on the right. And you can see kind of the growth of the core primary portfolio or going to direct investments is starting to take meaningful market share at close to 70% today. And performance by sub-portfolio. So the legacy portfolio has, you know, been in the ground longer, but the core portfolio has been performing higher in the short term. So feel good about the investments that we've been making really in the last 7 or 8 years, about a 15% net IRR, which is almost at the public market equivalent, just below, but more embedded kind of value in that portfolio as it's put to work.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty good pace when, I mean, from your last slide, going from fund to funds and, you know, going after our goal of primary, that looks like over 8 years, we really made a lot of headway there.
We made a lot of headway. I think, you know, as we mentioned up front and Brian hit on the fund to funds slide, that is starting to be distributed back to the plan, which has been a nice source of capital to reinvest in new higher returning strategies. I think this slide 21 just kind of places a finer point that the strategy is working. I won't go through this. This is a couple pages just on total private equity performance by vintage year, but did want to touch on, you know, cash flows. And so, as I mentioned, cumulative net cash flows became positive in 2021, obviously a very strong year for distributions, both generally across the market and also for Contra Costa. The last several years have been quite strong, too. Not everyone's charts look like this in terms of the positive net cash flows. So this year we're at, I think this is through September, you know, higher contributions than distributions. So hopefully, you know, will be a more meaningful 2026. I think this does reflect some of the net new activity and funds that we've committed to in the last 2 years. And then last couple comments just on diversification by strategy and fund type. I think this goes back to your question probably about benchmarking, right? Just getting the benchmarks closer to the actual exposures in the portfolio. Predominantly buyout, frankly, that 66% would be higher with a full look through of the fund of funds. So you can anticipate a decent portion of the fund of funds being buyout as well. Venture capital sitting around 15, 16%. That's almost entirely one venture fund of fund commitment. And that fund has performed quite well and is starting to distribute. But overall, fund-to-funds exposure coming down and a heightened emphasis, I think, on buyout and small mid-cap buyout. By investment manager and industry, quite diversified. So feel really good about this diversification. IT comes in a lot of different flavors. It's not unusual for our clients to have kind of 40% plus exposure to IT. But when you do a full look through of kind of the end markets that those tech companies touch, is pretty well diversified. Followed by kind of industrials, financials, and healthcare. You know, this is pretty similar to the deal activity that we're seeing in terms of IT and healthcare being some of the premium sectors that are trading. And then last but not least, just a quick snapshot on the real assets portfolio. When we started working with you back in 2017, this was a portfolio that was largely in runoff mode. We've kind of reinvigorated that pipeline here recently and started making some very targeted, opportunistic, and value-added investments. Really excited about some of the opportunities in infrastructure today. I think we just released our infrastructure house views today. So if you didn't get that, we can be sure to forward it to you. But overall, I think this is a mixed portfolio at this point, and I think we'll start to see some more positive momentum as the funds that we've committed to recently start to come online.
So what, just on the return, the 4.4%, how does that compare or stack up to both others in the real asset space? And it just struck me as 4.4%, right?
It's underwhelming and low. So that's not what we would expect for go-forward returns. We're typically underwriting to high single digits, low double digits on some of the infrastructure assets. Some of the growthier things like data centers are much higher. So it kind of depends on the asset and the category. In here, you have things like energy, water. I'm trying to think of what else touches this portfolio, but very, very kind of diversified, kind of older funds.
Yeah, and I would just add this. These are some stranded assets that were originally supposed to be inflation hedging assets. That was the mandate initially, going back to like 2010. So there was a couple fund of funds put in there, Aether and Common Fund. When the inflation hedging strategy was eliminated in a subsequent asset allocation, these private markets needed a home. This is kind of where they got shunted to. So they're not as pure play real assets as we'd be looking at on a go-forward basis.
Yeah, just, I can't remember what T-bills are at today, but I saw the 4.4%. I'm like, just seemed kind of low.
So. Yeah, and I think as we start to make more meaningful commitments to real assets, we added the real assets pacing slide in the last year. So we really haven't had a budget for net new activity until recently. And I think we'll probably do what we did with the legacy private equity assets to really show you how the go-forward strategy is working.
Yeah, I think that would be really helpful because otherwise it just gets thrown into the mix and it's an outlier, right?
Right.
And there's a story to it, as Kim alluded to. So I think that would be helpful to bracket it. So.
Sure.
Stranded assets. I think I have a few of those myself.
I have some stranded assets.
Anyway, just a question, just a reminder. On page 25 by strategy, you indicated there's something here called special situations. Give us an idea of what might fall into that category.
Sure. So, I mean, special situations is actually the stranded strategies. No, it's special situations would be, value-oriented, distressed restructuring funds, debt for control, anything, mezzanine, anything that doesn't fit in a buyout venture or growth equity bucket. Typically, opportunistic and special situations have a little bit lower target returns. So many LPs have actually retired some of the sub-strategies that used to fall in that bucket, because if you're taking the risk and doing private equity, you want to get the return for it. And so opportunistic and special situations historically has had more in the kind of low double-digit return, mid-teens return, versus kind of 15 to 20% target for a traditional buyout fund. And so debt for control certainly is a more cyclical investment strategy, and I think most private equity investors and LPs have come around to the fact that it probably doesn't fit well in a private equity structure. Same thing with mezzanine. Some of our clients actually put that in their fixed income bucket because of the lower returns and nature of the assets.
So is there a long-term goal to recategorize those to find a new home, or is there, will there always be a special situation?
Yeah, I think for Contra Costa, it'll be more opportunistic, higher growth strategies. Value-oriented funds, and we're looking at a couple right now. It's not debt for control, so there's not kind of anything hostile about the strategy. It's more about looking for value in the rough and turning around those assets. And so we'll do kind of value-oriented strategies probably as part of that.
And it's not dead money.
It's not dead money, yeah.
Can you comment on emerging managers? I mean, that's an attractive space, but the problem there, I think, is scale, correct? And so if we were to invest with emerging managers, it would kind of push us back into fund of funds type of situation that we're trying to avoid or to get away from. But is there some kind of setup with that where they're that active?
It's a good question. I think a lot of our clients are asking this question, maybe more focused on fund size and Roman numeral. There's a lot of research to suggest that small funds and funds earlier in their life tend to outperform. I think a lot of that has to do with the size companies that they're chasing and the ability to generate outsized returns. It also has to do with alignment of interest, if you think about the partner's personal capital as a percentage of overall net worth. So that being said, and the fact that we're seeing some real positive momentum out of the small cap space in the current environment, including net new distributions, higher revenue growth, we've been talking a lot with clients about pursuing the strategy in various different ways, and happy to talk to you about all the options. For large investors that have enough scale, one of the ways they can do that is through a separately managed account, and so they would just kind of hive off a percent of the budget to go after small cap funds with our help. Other clients try to do it more targeted and directly. And so to date, we've actually been doing that approach where I've been working with Brian to try to show some of the smaller funds that are more obscure, harder to find, harder to access, and try to get direct access to those funds. In some cases, you have to accept smaller commitment amounts. So it does become a relative choice in terms of capacity and team resources.
Yeah, right. It's tough, right, with the due diligence. I mean, we've had those talks before where if you invest $1 million versus $100 million, it's still the same amount of time that you have to put in because you have to do the due diligence. And so if there's a way to pool those investments into a larger group under another manager, but then again, you're getting towards the fund of funds type of strategy. So, but is that something
you can structure it different ways. So generally the two passive approaches would be a fund of funds or a separately managed account. A fund of funds, set it and forget it. Just all you have to do is make the commitment, do the underwriting. Separately managed account, typically a little bit more hands-on, or some of our clients like to have a little bit more involvement in terms of the manager selection. It's a bespoke portfolio, so it's specifically tailored to you. It's a fund of one. So there's pros and cons. And typically SMAs can be cheaper as well.
So this could be kind of an exception. I mean, if the returns are there to make it worth a while, then saying, okay, well, you want to get away from fund of funds except for in this case. So, right.
Good question.
All right, any other questions before we wrap up? Go ahead, Natalie. Was that it?
That was it, yeah. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. No, I appreciated the Ron Popeil reference to set it and forget it. Classic moment.
I think just sort of final comment, just around pacing. You know, we put out pacing plans and sort of pacing dollar amounts, but the way staff views it is guidelines, guardrails, but we're not going to force capital out just to get it out to get to a 15% target. If you look at 2024, we did $230 million in commitments, and it's just a function of high-quality GPs in the market. That's who we're going to go after. There might be years that we don't hit that pacing, but it's really, we're not trying to force that capital out. We only want top-tier, high-quality GPs.
I appreciate that. That's very comforting, I'm sure, for everybody. So it's a great strategy.